Good morning.
Morning.
We're all happy to be here today. We hope you are too. If we don't have our court together in person in Carson City very often. This is the first time in a long time it's been handled remotely. So we're, like I said, we're happy to be here. We have three important cases today. The first case is Hayes versus Watson, case number 85087-COA. This is the time set for oral argument. I'm joined by Judge Bonnie Bola to my left and Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right. And I see we have counsel Ms. Jensen for the appellant. And then who's with you today?
Steve Wynn, Your Honor.
Wynn. All right. And Russell Carr for the respondent.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Be the first time for Mr. Carr to appear in front of me. So happy to see you again. Ms. Jensen, would the appellant like to reserve any time for the rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay. Right. This case has a number of issues, and of course, this court is interested in all of them. But we particularly like counsel to address the issues regarding the videotaped deposition of Dr. Watson. What led up to the ruling from the court, what exactly the court's ruling was, and what it prevented the appellant from doing. Further, the actual videotaped deposition is not in the record, so if that could be addressed too. Judge Bola, do you have anything to say before we start?
Good morning. Happy Monday.
Judge Westbrook?
Good morning and happy Monday. Yeah, this is actually the first time I've had the opportunity to sit in the Carson City courtroom, so this is quite exciting.
Okay. All right. Ms. Jensen, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jan Jensen with the Laxalt Law Group here representing Britt Hayes. Ms. Hayes is here in the courtroom with us today. There are, as Judge Gibbons noted, a number of issues raised in our appeal, so I'll begin with the videotape depositions, and then, time allowing, I'd like to address the exclusion of the other evidence, other conduct evidence, as well as the attorney misconduct in the repetition of references to work comp benefits. With regard to the video clips, during trial, I had indicated to Judge Draculich that I intended to play for the jury certain clips from the videotape deposition of Dr. Watson. Judge Draculich said that that would not be allowed because Dr. Watson was present and able to testify, and if I wanted to use it for impeachment, that I may be allowed to do so. But the purpose of offering the deposition video clips was not to impeach Dr. Watson. It was to show the jury the difference between his persona at the deposition and what we believed was the staged persona for purposes of trial. The references to the video clips are attached as Exhibit 3 to our motion for new trial, the actual testimony we were seeking to show by the video clip. But I do apologize, I did not at the time of trial offer those actual clips. I believed Judge Draculich was not going to allow them, and that was my mistake in not presenting them, but the content of the clips is included in the record. So what we wanted to show with Dr. Watson's video clips were his, what I believe, his true persona. Dr. Watson, in my opinion, is extremely condescending, extremely egotistical, and was belittling the content of this case that is so important to Ms. Hayes. In his deposition, which was videotaped, he said he acknowledged he threw the backboard. He acknowledged that he screams at techs, other people in the room, and just his demeanor during that deposition was so different from his trial testimony that I felt it was important for the jury to see how he responded to questions not in front of them.
Ms. Jensen, do you have any legal authority to support that video clips from depositions can be played to a jury for purposes of evaluating a witness's demeanor? Because, again, the argument is the doctor was present at trial and testifying at trial.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe under Rule 32, the deposition of a party can be used for any purpose. The use of videotape depositions is evolving. When I started this practice, there was no such thing as a videotape deposition. Now it's commonplace. And people don't always do videotape depositions simply to preserve testimony for an elderly client or something like that. It's for the very purpose of showing what the person is like. I don't believe there is any Nevada authority at all on the use of video clips, and I was unable to locate any authority that's directly on point here. But we have the rule, which is clear and unambiguous. It does not require that the party not be present to use the deposition. It's very clear that the deposition can be used for any purpose.
How do we address NRS 51.325, which the respondent has relied on to suggest that the witness still must be unavailable?
I don't believe that's in the rule, Your Honor. The rule, subsection 1 of the rule, talks about using other people's depositions, a witness, someone who might not be available, someone who might be beyond the subpoena power of a litigant. But the subsection about parties clearly says for any purpose. And while there hasn't been any Nevada case on that, there was a case, excuse me, in response to the case cited by the respondent, following that case, and I believe it was there's a subsequent case out of Florida that says, that addressed the use for any purpose. Wasn't a videotape, but it was for any purpose, which the judge denied because the person was present in court. And that case is Castaneda versus Redlands Christian. It's at 884 Southern 2nd, 1087. That was a 2004 case where the court said the failure to follow the rules constitutes an error of law, not an abuse of discretion. That it was an error of law not to allow the deposition to be used, although the party was present.
So how can we determine whether or not the error was a harmful error or a harmless error, or what was the impact at trial?
I believe by the court completely excluding them, and then when I did attempt to use a video clip for impeachment, she told me to use the written transcript. Regardless of what the video clips may be interpreted as by the jury, I believe it was an error of law not to allow the video clips to be shown. It was up to the jury to decide, is this difference significant or not? In my opinion, it was very, very different.
Counsel, does Rule 32 distinguish between video depositions and transcripts?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, Your Honor. It says the deposition. And in fact, currently, there is not even a requirement that a court reporter be present for a video deposition. I was just in an e-deposition where there is simply a notary public and a video camera, and there is no court reporter. So in that instance, the only record that's the official record is the videotape. Now, the rule doesn't specifically address that, but it just says deposition. It doesn't say written transcript of deposition or video deposition. It simply says deposition. So I believe that by disregarding that rule, the clear intent of that rule, to allow the use of a deposition of a party for any purpose was violated by the trial court and is reason enough to allow this case to go back so Ms. Hayes can get her fair trial.
Okay, so Ms. Jensen, you said you wanted to show clips. Was the original request to show the entire deposition?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, and you can tell in Judge Draculich's order denying the motion for a new trial, she specifically says clips. There were probably less than 10 pages total. I believe there were 6 different video clips, each very short. But no, we did not intend to play the whole deposition. If that was the purpose, Your Honor, then I think the respondent would have the right to say, well, when there were objections or back and forth between counsel, we'd need to edit that. That was not at all ever offered to use the entire video.
Was there any objection to specific clips other than what the record shows? There was a hearsay objection?
No, Your Honor. It was, Dr. Watson's here. You shouldn't be allowed to use the video. Okay. And I argued his presence there is not a reason to deny the use of the deposition.
Okay. So what would have happened, do you think, had the clips been allowed, all of them?
I believe if the jury had been allowed to see the clips of Dr. Watson's deposition testimony, the clips, they would have seen, for example, in his deposition, he said, I asked, were you yelling? He said, I don't know what yelling is. I've never heard a recording of my voice. Those types of things the jury would have seen. And I believe it would have made a difference in their deliberations.
Did you refer to the parts of the deposition transcript, the page number, in your motion for the new trial where you cited to the video excerpts?
Yes, Your Honor. That's Exhibit 3 to our motion for new trial. They're attached. The written portions of what we expected to offer is attached.
So those weren't intended for impeachment per se?
No.
They were just to show the demeanor of the witness.
Exactly, Your Honor. So if he says, I don't know if I was yelling or not, is that really impeachment when he condescendingly says, I've never heard a recording of myself, so I can't tell you if I yell?
Was there any claim on the other side, well, this would be out of context, so you should show the whole video?
We never reached that, Your Honor. The judge just decided, Dr. Watson's present, you are not using the videos.
All right, you said you wanted to mention the other issues. If you can do that very briefly, then you can cover it more in rebuttal.
Okay, just very briefly, Your Honor, the other incidents, there was a dispute about exclusion of the MIDAS reports as opposed to testimony regarding other incidents. The trial court decided that because we had not requested a Petrocelli hearing prior to trial, that those would not be allowed. I believe, and I have further argument, that that's not Nevada law. In the 2 civil cases where that came up, it was the defense who raised the issue, and then the court had a hearing. We never had a hearing here, which I believe denied Ms. Hayes her right to a fair trial. The work comp evidence was pervasive throughout the trial. Over objections, the judge never sustained the objections during closing argument. She never admonished counsel, never admonished the jury. So those errors, I believe, under PV show that there was counsel misconduct, and under Leochi, even unobjected misconduct can be reversible error. I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Carr, as you could see, Ms. Jensen focused on the video deposition as the court asked, but she brought up the other 2 issues, too, regarding the MIDAS reports and workers' comp issues. And she's mentioned a couple times attorney misconduct. So she said she's going to come back to that in rebuttal, so just be prepared then to address all of those things.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
May I begin?
Go ahead.
May it please the court, my name is Russell Carr, and I represent the respondents, Dr. Watson and Western Surgical Group. As this court is aware, litigants are entitled to a fair trial, but not a perfect trial. This case is about an emergency room surgeon that was trying to save a patient's life when he dropped a backboard on an experienced nurse's foot. The issues in this case arise in that context. The jury heard that Dr. Watson was caring for a patient that was involved in a serious car crash and was designated at the highest level of trauma and had a potentially life-threatening head injury. In a six-day jury trial, the jury weighed the credibility of the witnesses and concluded that Dr. Watson was not negligent. Ms. Hayes received a fair trial and reversal is not warranted. Responding to Mrs. Hayes' argument that the district court improperly prevented her from using Dr. Watson's videotaped deposition, I submit that the district court did not abuse its discretion. Ms. Hayes argues that she should have been allowed to use the videotape to show Dr. Watson's demeanor in his deposition, which purportedly differed from his demeanor at trial. NRCP 32A1B states that a deposition may be used at trial to the extent it would be admissible if the deponent were present and testifying.
Well, Mr. Carr, let me interrupt. What authority do you rely on to support that a party witness, not just any witness, but a party witness, must be unavailable for a videotaped deposition to be used?
Your Honor, I do believe that this is a novel issue of Nevada law. I submit that a plain meaning interpretation of NRCP 32A1B and 32 subsection A3 leads to the conclusion that the deponent still has to be unavailable. I submit that...
Why do you believe that?
When reading the rule in context, Your Honor, it does not appear that subsection A3 disperses of the requirements of subsection A1.
Counsel, don't we generally apply the specific governing the general rule when we construe statutes and rules? In this case, subsection 1B is in a section entitled in general. And isn't subsection 3 a more specific provision such that that would take precedence in that specific circumstance?
I would concede, Your Honor, that it's more specific. I don't necessarily concede that it would take precedence. I think we still have all of NRS Chapter 48, 49, 50 that would deal with various evidentiary provisions. I don't think it would make sense to conclude that all the other requirements of evidence, such as unfair prejudice, relevance, would be dispersed of because of that rule.
What do we do with the language in subsection 4 that discusses unavailable witnesses and says specifically whether or not a party, indicating that that section is not necessarily limited to parties, and that the party provision is governed by subsection 3.
I do understand that concern, Your Honor. However, I think at the heart of this issue is that even if the district court applied an erroneous interpretation of the rule, I submit that any error in this case would be harmless. If we turn to the Coletti case, which is cited...
Mr. Carr, before we go to harmlessness, in looking at the transcript, the district court had a hearing on it, said it was not familiar with the rule or this situation of the rule. Heard argument from counsel, said, all right, we'll come back the next day and I'll give you my ruling. And there's very, very brief argument the next day. The court let the appellant put their statement on the record, or make the record, I think is how it was phrased, that Rule 32 was mentioned again. It says any party, this is a party, and the court just moved on. But the focus of the court's discussion seemed to be about the hearsay rule, and you've just briefly touched on it, referring to other statutes. What I don't understand is, why are we even talking about the exceptions to the hearsay rule when this is a party, so by definition it's non-hearsay?
Your Honor, I don't disagree with that point. I don't have a specific answer to that. Obviously, I was not the trial counsel. But in that regard, what I would say is that Ms. Hayes has argued throughout this case that she wanted to use the video to compare Dr. Watson's demeanor in his deposition with his demeanor at trial. NRS 50.075 defines impeachment as attacking the credibility of a witness. I believe believe that Ms. Hayes was essentially trying to impeach Dr. Watson using his videotape deposition under the definition provided by NRS 50.075. The district court did allow Ms. Hayes to use the videotape for impeachment. The district court's order did say that.
But Mr. Carr, I'm sorry to interrupt, but when it came to trial and the video clips were attempted to be used, arguably, for impeachment or refreshing recollection, the court instructed the attorney to use the transcript, the written transcript. So is it a fair statement that the appellant was able to use the video clips for impeachment in this particular case?
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that at that point of the record, which is at page 1256, Ms. Hayes attempted to use a video clip. She was attempting to refresh Dr. Watson's recollection about a part of his deposition testimony. The district court ruled that she was it would just be easier to use the transcript in that situation.
But the rule would have allowed her to use the video clips of the deposition for the purpose of impeachment or refreshing recollection. If we focus on Rule 32 that permits the use of a deposition for any purpose.
I would concede that point, Your Honor. But I would say that any error in this case is harmless.
Okay. But again, you want to move on to that, and you'll do it in just a second here. But just to clarify this legal point, so I asked Ms. Jensen, could you have played the whole video? And she said, that's not what we were trying to do. But if it says any party, and it's non-hearsay, then the whole deposition could have been played absent some other objection not related to hearsay or the interpretation of Rule 32.
And Your Honor, I do believe that creates a pragmatic concern, because if we take this very broad definition under the rule for any purpose, essentially a party could come in and play the entire deposition, which could confuse the jury.
That's a different issue, though. Just using Rule 32 and the hearsay rule, there's no other objection possible, hypothetically, the whole deposition could be played under those two rules of a party as non-hearsay.
But potentially, yes, Your Honor. But I submit that if this court issued precedents stating the same, it would create massive confusion at trial.
The burden is on the person objecting, saying, like you would in any other case, you object to portions of it that, for whatever reason, don't come in. But you cannot use Rule 32 or the hearsay rule when it's a party opponent and the rule says can be used for any purpose. So that's the way it appears to read. Now, we'll move on to harmlessness. I'll give you one last chance to tell me why that's not what it really means.
Your Honor, I would just say that when you're reading that rule in the context of the Nevada revised statutes, when as you're sitting as a district court judge and you have the duty to conduct a fair trial, allowing the unfettered ability to play the deposition without a clear and articulable evidentiary purpose would mislead and confuse the jury.
Well, Mr. Carr, the Nevada Supreme Court in the case of Mitchell held that a statute of court procedure was unconstitutional as it relates to NRCP Rule 35 exams. Do you consider Rule 32 a rule of procedure? Why or why not?
So, Your Honor, my understanding is correct. I remember that the legislature enacted NRS 52.380, which provided procedural mechanisms for the Rule 35 examinations. The Nevada Supreme Court held that statute was unconstitutional. This would be a rule of procedure under Rule 35 because the Nevada Supreme Court obviously authored this rule.
So if there was a statute that potentially conflicted with Rule 32, which you would agree with me is a rule of procedure?
I do agree that it's a rule of procedure, Your Honor.
Would the court not then be able to use Rule 32 to resolve any conflict between the statute and the rule?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it would depend on whether and what provisions specifically conflicted in the factual context. I know that, and for instance, that the case Lyft, which did describe the conflict between 52.380 and Rule 35, the court examined the specific conflict with the statute compared to the rule. In that case, the court concluded that the rule governed rather than the statute.
And of course, we don't have any case law currently with respect to Rule 32.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so Ms. Hayes was not intending to play the whole video, but to play certain excerpts during cross-examination. You indicated, Mr. Carr, that excluding that was harmless. Could you explain that?
Well, yes, Your Honor. We cited to the Coletti case, which is a case from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in our brief at pages 30 through 31. In that case, in interpreting the federal analog to Nevada's rule, the 10th Circuit held that the district court was well within its discretion to limit the use of the videotape to purposes of impeachment. The 10th Circuit noted that the appellant in that case never attempted to use the videotape deposition to impeach, and therefore there was no error that warranted reversal. I submit to the court that the factual pattern here is highly analogous to the facts in the Coletti case. I'd like to next turn to Ms. Hayes' argument that prior bad act evidence was improperly excluded.
Well, but I don't know if you finished on harmlessness. I heard the point made in the argument today is only the video could show the demeanor of the witness, of the opponent, party opponent, Dr. Watson. Therefore, the jury wasn't able to see the contrast between how he appeared at the deposition versus how he appeared at trial, which she called it staged. So how do you get around that when you're not talking about the content per se of the video, but the actual appearance of the witness? And as you know, the standard jury instruction instructs the jury to look at the demeanor of the witness.
So, Your Honor, my response to that is that we don't have a clear record, a clear appellate record of how the video would impeach or challenge Dr. Watson's credibility in his deposition. I want to point to page 1592 of the record. Ms. Hayes impeached Dr. Watson using his deposition transcript and didn't attempt to use the video. She didn't put on the record how the video would show his demeanor changed in his deposition compared to trial. So in that regard, I believe that this court is slightly limited in trying to determine how the demeanor changed between the deposition and trial such that reversal is warranted.
Did counsel make the demeanor argument below, though? Without an offer of proof, but simply raise that objection that that was the purpose for which they wanted to present that those clips.
I do. Yes, Your Honor. That yes.
Okay. All right, Mr. Carr. Sorry, we keep interrupting. You probably should move on then to the other points. Ms. Jensen identified several, as I stated at the outset. So go from there.
Yes, Your Honor. So in terms of the prior bad act evidence, I respectfully submit that this argument does not warrant reversal. Before prior bad act evidence is admitted, the proponent does have a duty to show that it's relevant, supported by clear and convincing evidence, and that the probative value of the evidence is substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. The district court found that Ms. Hayes never established that any of these Midas reports were established by clear and convincing evidence.
Was there even a hearing on it, though?
I do not believe that there was a specific Petroselli hearing. The court looked at the briefing of the parties.
So the documents are offered as an exhibit obtained during discovery. The defense files a motion in limine to exclude, and then there's no hearing. The court just rules on it, and these arguments weren't fleshed out, and the court sua sponte raised a hearsay objection to the evidence, and so that was never argued by the parties either.
But, Your Honor, I would say that nowhere in the record or in the appellate briefs as Ms. Hayes showed how this evidence is supported by clear and convincing evidence. She's also not shown how...
Don't you have a hearing so those things can be done and find out exactly what evidence is going to be offered?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, in both the appellate briefing and the trial court briefing, that issue was never identified. And more importantly, under NRS 48.0452, the proponent has to show how the evidence would have been used for plan, intent, motive, opportunity. Nowhere in the record is it shown how the evidence fit one of the criteria in that statute.
Okay. All right, how about the workers' comp issue? I know you're out of time here, but again, I interrupted you when you were turning to it. If you want to briefly comment on that.
Yes, Your Honor. So on that issue, I think that the crux of this court's analysis should be that despite references to workers' compensation payments, the jury did not reach a threshold determination that Dr. Watson was negligent. The references to collateral sources would have had an impact on damages, but not on a threshold finding of negligence. In this case, the jury weighed the testimony of various witnesses and concluded that Dr. Watson was not negligent. And I want to point out that the district court did tell the jury in the closing arguments after Dr. Watson referenced the collateral source payments that it was supposed to follow Instruction 30. Instruction 30 is a page 1967 of the record. In Instruction 30, it took the statement from NRS 616C.21510, and it told the jury that if it reached judgment for Ms. Hayes on the negligence issue, it had to disregard any references to workers' compensation payments.
So, Mr. Carr, just quickly, is it your position then that even though there were multiple references to the workers' compensation payment throughout trial, that did not have any effect on the outcome?
Your Honor, that is my position. And I do want to, if the court will allow me additional time, I do want to point to the differences.
Please answer the question so that's permissible.
Thank you, Your Honor. If we turn to the Kramer v. Peavy case, the references to workers' compensation in that case were respectfully far more egregious than what Dr. Watson said. In that case, they said the poor old insurance company was left holding the bag. In this case, while we did reference the workers' compensation payments below, we did not make an egregious statement like that invited the jury to feel sympathy for the insurance company. For the following reasons, I submit that Ms. Hayes received a fair trial and that reversal is not warranted. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carr. All right, Ms. Jensen, you can proceed with the rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding the video clips, the credibility was critical in this case. When Dr. Watson testified at trial, he made a staged apology to Ms. Hayes 5 years after the incident. I believe the jury lapped it up and they didn't have the chance to see what his true demeanor was.
Didn't the jury hear see the written apology that was made earlier?
The written apology, Your Honor, Dr. Watson testified was dictated to him upon threat of suspension of his hospital privileges. It wasn't something he came up with.
Did Dr. Gomez ever comment on that point?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because Dr. Gomez was allowed to testify, although he was not disclosed as a witness in the case. And on the second day of trial, the judge reversed her prior decisions to allow Dr. Gomez to testify and then limited my cross-examination to the limited direct. That was another error, we believe.
Ms. Jensen, had you finished your case before Dr. Gomez was testifying, or did you try to call him in your case in chief and were told no?
We could not call him, Your Honor. Just as a background, the defense accepted a subpoena for Dr. Harold Kennedy, who was the original 30B6 designee for Western Surgical. Dr. Kennedy didn't show. He didn't come to trial. So then they said, we want to use Dr. Gomez. At the time they announced that, Dr. Gomez was in Utah. We couldn't subpoena him. We couldn't get him for our case in chief. And when he was allowed to testify, it was for scripted testimony from the defense, including standard of care testimony that had never, ever been disclosed by the defense. So that's a separate issue. I see I'm running out of time, so I just want to address very quickly the work comp references. I think although we objected throughout the trial and there were pervasive references, I think the most grievous error was when defense counsel said in closing, Britt was not satisfied with the letter and verbal apology. She was not satisfied that workers' compensation was paying her medical bills. That had to have impacted the jury. I objected, and the trial court simply told defense counsel, move on. There was no ruling on my objection. Then later in the closing argument, defense counsel said that the court had decided the lien was relevant, and I quote, should be considered by you in reaching your decision. Improper, direct violation of Nevada law, and the only thing the trial court did was say, you'll have a jury instruction on this. Did not rule on the objection, did not admonish counsel, did not admonish the jury. And I believe under Nevada law, especially the Leochi decision, that was the requirement, that she rule on the objections, sustain the objection, and admonish. And those comments, in addition to the multiple comments throughout the trial, did impact the jury. This jury was out for less than 2 hours, including lunch. They'd made up their mind before there was any deliberation. And just briefly, on the Petrocelli hearing, there is no Nevada authority that says the proponent of the evidence in a civil case must request a Petrocelli hearing.
Is there anything to the contrary?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I believe in the criminal law context, there is case authority that says the prosecution has that burden. But I think in a criminal case, we have constitutional issues, due process issues, those sorts of things that are not present in the civil arena. And in both Taylor versus Thunder and Bongiovi versus Sullivan, the Nevada Supreme Court never said the proponent of the evidence in a civil case has that burden.
Are you aware of any case where the Supreme Court's held that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to exclude other bad act evidence without holding a Petrocelli hearing?
I believe in Taylor, a Petrocelli hearing was held, so that we didn't reach that point. In Bongiovi, Petrocelli's not even mentioned. There's no reference. It just says the district court was correct in allowing the testimony of the two former employees who said defendant Dr. Bongiovi had made disparaging comments about other plastic surgeons in the past. So that was found to be not an abuse of discretion to allow that testimony.
But did you have a chance, though, to respond in writing to this?
We had no chance, Your Honor. We had nothing. The trial court made the decision. You didn't raise it, plaintiff. You're barred from using it now.
Right, but there's a motion in limine filed to exclude these reports, and the court does issue a ruling that goes through what the parties were arguing.
For the reports, Your Honor, we, after the judge's ruling on that pretrial, we never offered the reports. We were looking for witness testimony, percipient witnesses who observed this behavior and conduct, not the reports. We didn't try to offer the reports at all, other than the one about this incident.
Didn't the court's order, though, contain language indicating that if you had attempted or you were going to attempt to provide witness testimony, that would be inappropriate because, under the bad act analysis, it was not, not more probative than prejudicial?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because in the order regarding the motion in limine, the order says there's good cause to exclude the Midas reports. Then later, when we were in the midst of arguing the motion for mistrial, the court said her order was trying to signal to plaintiff that if you want this evidence, you need to file a motion. But that's not what the order says. The order doesn't say if this is an issue, we need to have a Petrocelli hearing.
Ms. Jensen, did you identify the witnesses that you wanted to call in 16.1 disclosures? And did you identify what testimony they would potentially be giving at trial?
I believe so, Your Honor. Each of our trial witnesses was disclosed pursuant to 16.1 with a description of their testimony. Off the top of my head, I believe that include Frank Robertson, Morgan's last name, but she's another nurse, as well as Ms. Hayes and Dr. Watson. Dr. Watson admitted to all of this prior conduct in his deposition. We did not attempt to use the Midas reports to impeach him about what he did or didn't do. We were only looking for testimony from other witnesses who had been disclosed about these other incidents. I apologize, I've gone over my time.
All right, thank you, Ms. Jensen. Mr. Carr, Ms. Jensen did mention something from the record that was not discussed in her opening argument about Dr. Kennedy not appearing, and therefore this issue coming up about Dr. Gomez. If there's anything that you think was procedurally or factually incorrect from what she said, not to argue what it means, but just the facts, I'll give you a chance to state it. If you don't think there was anything incorrect, well, this stance will stand submitted.
I don't have any corrections, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. So the general rule is you can't bring up things in rebuttal that aren't referenced in the opening argument because the other side doesn't get a chance to respond. All right. Excellent job by both attorneys. This really helps the court here in rendering a decision in this case. There's a lot of record, a lot of things happening. It's obviously an extremely important case, and we're looking at it very closely. And we, again, thank you for your very good presentations today. I can't tell you when we'll have a decision. We'll have this under submission. But as I said, we're proceeding very carefully, as I'm sure you would all want us to do. All right.